Dixis Morrill is the founder of Halleck Institute and was the first person to file a constitutional challenge against the National Security Letters statute in the USA Patriot Act. After receiving a National Security Letter from the FBI, he sued the FBI and the Department of Justice and became the plaintiff in the lawsuit Doe versus Ashcroft filed April 9, 2004 by the ACLU and the New York Civil Liberties Union on behalf of the owner of a formerly unknown internet service provider against the U.S. federal government. Nick Morrill was the internet service provider. In 2007, he won the Roger Baldwin Medal of Liberty Award from the ACLU, which had to present the award to an empty chair. And Morrill has founded the nonprofit Halleck Institute, as I mentioned, to provide education and research on privacy issues. Welcome, Nicholas Morrill, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you here, and I guess you can say what a long, strange trip it's been, right out of Kafka.
Yeah. A lot of people have actually made that analogy. There were a lot of interesting Kafkaesque moments in the journey.
Now, you are we're a small internet provider, and one day the FBI came knocking on your door with a national security letter. Tell us how that happened and what was entailed here.
Well, basically, literally the way it went down was I got a telephone call. And the person who called me said that they were from the FBI and that they were sending someone by my office with a letter. I wasn't even sure whether to take it seriously or not. And I had a lot of work to do. So I just kind of ignored it and went back to work. And sure enough, a few hours later, there was actually a knock at my door. And when I answered the door, there was an actual agent standing there wearing a trench coat. And it was exactly as stereotypical as you could imagine. The agent pulled out a letter from the inside pocket of the trench coat and handed it to me. And so what I did was I took the letter out from the envelope and I read it. And it was really quite a heavy-handed letter. It commanded me to provide a bunch of information about one of Calix's clients, one of the internet provider's clients. And it said that I had to provide the information in person, that I couldn't fax it, email it, send it in the postal mail, and that one of the, you know, really glaring aspects of the letter was that it said I could never tell any person that I'd been approached by the FBI. It also made it clear that I was commanded to provide this information, but it didn't really explain under what authority the FBI was commanding me to do so. Because what I had originally looked for in the letter was some kind of a stamp from a judge or from a court, and there was none. Instead, the letter was signed by an attorney who worked at the FBI.
So this is an FBI operation that does not require a judge's approval, judge's stamp.
Right. You know, as someone that has worked in the telecommunications industry for many years, typically what would happen when someone makes a demand for information would be that they have to go to court, and they have to get a judge to sign off on their request, whether it's a search warrant or a subpoena or something like that. This letter seemed to act like one of those documents, but since it wasn't issued by a court, it just kind of set off a red flag in my mind. I wondered, what authority does the FBI have to demand that I provide all this information? And when I read the letter, and when I got to the point where it said that I could never tell any person, it was very, you know, it was very clear, no person. I looked up at the agent and I said something to the effect of, what about my lawyer? What about my business partners? And the FBI agent who came and visited me just kind of shrugged and didn't really answer, and said something to the effect that, you know, that the agent had been given the job of delivering the letter and, you know, made it sound like there was no authority for that agent to give me permission to do anything or to interpret anything that was said in the letter. Then the agent had me sign a receipt of some sort and left. And at that point, I was left with this letter that cited all these portions of federal law and was written in thick legalese. And I'm not an attorney. So I thought about it and thought about it. And despite the fact that the letter commanded me to not tell anyone, I decided to call my lawyer because I didn't really feel qualified to interpret all these portions of the federal code that the letter cited. And I felt certain that despite that the letter told me never to tell anyone, I felt certain that I always have the right to talk to a lawyer since I'm an American. So that's what I did. I called my lawyer. I disobeyed the commandment to never tell anyone. And what happened at that point was, luckily for me, I guess, the New York Civil Liberties Union, which is the New York affiliate of the ACLU, was a client of my internet provider, and I hosted their website. So I had some contact info there, and my lawyer and I called them, and we got an appointment with them right away. And pretty soon I was sitting in their office, and I showed them the letter. And they made a phone call to the ACLU office, which was in the same building. And an attorney from ACLU came down and looked at the letter also. And they all seemed to agree that the legality of this request was at best questionable. But at that point, I had already violated the FBI's commandment to not tell any person several times over. And there were big questions about how could we challenge this request without further violating the gag order. And that led to basically a long legal adventure that lasted over 6 years, winded through the court systems, and actually resulted in the national security letters portion of the Patriot Act being declared unconstitutional. Not once, but twice.
Has that had any effect on the issue of national security letters, as far as you're aware? Well, we can't possibly know that because of the nature of the national security letters.
Well, I mean, there are some things that we know. For instance, after the 2004 ruling, which was the first ruling on the constitutionality of the statute, the Congress went back and modified the law, and they made a kind of a half-hearted attempt to deal with some of the constitutional issues that the judge in my case pointed out to them. The judge in my case declared the statute to be in violation of the First Amendment because of the gag order, the never-ending gag order, and also in violation of the Fourth Amendment because of the search without going before a judge, and also in violation of the Fifth Amendment in terms of due process, because the statute as it was written didn't have any provision for going to court to challenge the gag order or the search. And basically, in a lot of ways, what the Congress ended up doing was it kind of wrote new provisions into the law that said that whatever I had done was now legal in terms of when I told attorneys and when I went to court. But unfortunately, they also added a few other provisions to the law, which in some ways made the law a little bit worse. And the government actually appealed that decision. So despite the fact that we won on paper, we didn't really win the war, so to speak, because since the government appealed their law, the judge withheld his order, which ordered them to stop issuing national security letters, and that allowed them to continue. And then when we got to the next level of court, the appeals court level, which is sort of the court directly below the Supreme Court, when they finally heard the case, which was several years later, They said, hey, listen, the law that you challenged was that law, and now the law has been changed. Now it's this law. So we're going to send you back to the bottom. So they kicked us back to the beginning, the very beginning, to where we had begun in 2004.
Now, whose Justice Department did that?
All of this happened during the Bush years. The case began in 2004, and it still isn't really completely over. But when I got partially released from the gag order, that was in 2010 during Obama's administration under Eric Holder. The case lasted so long that there were four different attorney generals during that time period. The case was originally known as Doe versus Ashcroft, and then later it became Doe versus Mukasey, and then later Doe versus Gonzalez, and it ended up finally as being Doe versus Holder.
Is there, can you see any difference in the response of the let's say, the Holder to your case or to the issue than his predecessors?
You know, I have questions about that. What happened in 2010 was, you know, the case had continued to wind its way through the courts, and one of the last proceedings that we had was challenging the continuation of the gag order on me, which by 2010 had already lasted over 6 years. And what we asked for was for me to be completely released from the gag order. But this goes back to what I mentioned before in terms of how when Congress amended the law in the period of 2005 to 2006 in response to the first constitutional ruling, they added a provision to the law that says that if in court, if the FBI asserts that the gag order is needed for national security, then their assertion is to be treated as conclusive. And that's basically what happened in my case. I made arguments, which I can't really get into because I'm still mostly gagged and I can't talk about most of the details of the case. So I can't really tell you what the arguments were, unfortunately. But I made a whole bunch of arguments, which I thought were really good arguments. And then what the government did in response to that was to make a secret argument using secret evidence that they only showed to the judge inside the judge's private chamber. And neither myself nor my attorneys were allowed to read or hear the government's argument. And the judge, under the law, had no choice other than to treat their assertions as conclusive. So we were never able to make a counter-argument against the evidence, which we didn't even know what it said anyway. But this, getting back to your question of has the case been treated differently under the Obama administration as it was under the Bush administration, maybe so, because at some point someone made the call that I would be allowed to be partially ungagged. This was after we lost our argument in court. I asked the attorneys to try to make a deal, a deal not in court, outside of court settlement. And the settlement, the terms of the settlement were that I would stop suing them, and in return, they would allow me to identify myself as the plaintiff in the case and to admit publicly that I had received a national security letter. Those are the entire terms. Then there's a whole complicated agreement that came with it, which explains what facts of the case I'm allowed to talk about and what facts I'm not allowed to talk about. And just to give you an idea of how difficult it is for me to speak about the case, like even right now, my attorneys made for me a guide, a written guide on how to speak publicly about the case without running into problems with the gag order. And the guide is 6 pages long, single-spaced. So it's very complex, and it actually requires a lot of thought. Anytime I say something, I have to think of all the thousands of facts that were redacted in the court document. And any fact that was ever redacted, other than my name or my company's name, I really can't say. So it basically makes it like I'm walking through a minefield every time I want to speak about the case. Because if I was to even inadvertently disclose one of those facts, I could face prison time, something like 5 years.
It's a remarkable, remarkable story. Going back a bit, you were not allowed to tell members of your family, and your father passed away without ever knowing what you were going through. Perhaps you could talk about that. My guest, by the way, Nicholas Merrill, who was a victim of the U.S. Patriot Act, and you haven't heard much about him because he wasn't allowed to talk about it. So maybe you could talk about how that went down.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, basically, from 2004 through August of 2010, I was completely under a gag order. And that's why the case was known as Doe versus Ashcroft. Instead of it having my name, normally the case would have been called something like Merrill versus Ashcroft. But in my case, it had to be filed using a pseudonym. And the reason for that was that the FBI, for many years, argued that if I were to be identified, then somehow it would be a threat to national security. Now, I kind of suspect that the FBI uses gag orders to prevent there being that much public discussion about how the Patriot Act is being used. And so for all those years, there was still quite a bit of public debate about the Patriot Act and how it was being used. Despite the fact that my case was under the name Doe, when we won the case, there were headlines saying that the Patriot Act had been struck down, parts of the Patriot Act had been struck down, and that some anonymous internet provider was the plaintiff in the case. Soon afterwards, when Congress began to have hearings about it and discuss the problems that were pointed out by the judge, the FBI came and they testified, and I had to sit there quietly and just kind of sit on my hands, and I wasn't allowed to make any public statements about it. And I felt that I had some evidence that the government was abusing these powers. But the FBI went and testified saying that they hadn't really received any complaints, which was quite ironic because every person that they had given a national security letter to was under a gag order. So obviously, nobody could really complain about it, since if they spoke, they faced years in prison. So during those years, 2004 through 2010, nobody that I knew had any idea that I was the plaintiff in this case, including all those people closest to me, my parents, my girlfriends at the time, my friends, my colleagues, and even my clients at my company. There would be a lot of discussion about it, particularly when I would hang around in industry circles. I would hang out with colleagues from other internet providers or other web hosting companies, and people were talking about the case. And I was formerly a very outspoken person about the Patriot Act and about these issues, and I really had to keep my mouth shut for fear of sounding like I knew too much about the issue. And I didn't want to invite more questions that would put me in a difficult position. I was very fearful of getting in trouble for even inadvertently letting people think that they knew who was the plaintiff. So I was always very careful to not tell anyone. And as you mentioned, during those years, my father became ill. He was diagnosed with cancer. And his illness lasted quite a while, lasted several years. And during that time, I wrote an op-ed article that was published anonymously in the Washington Post, and the portion of the Patriot Act was declared unconstitutional twice. And, my father and I used to love to discuss politics. He had been the art director of Time magazine throughout the 70s, and we differed on a lot of issues, but we'd like to talk about politics all the time, and I wasn't able to explain to him what was going on with me. You know, he would say, "What's going on in your life? How is everything?" And I would have to just lie to him about it. I'd say, "Well, same old, everything's fine." And, you know, for someone to be put in a position where you have to lie, either directly or indirectly, or lying by omission to those closest to you is a really uncomfortable kind of a position to be put in, both on a personal level and in terms of professional ethics. You know, clients of mine at the time would sometimes ask, "Do you know anything about this?" And I would have to say no. And so eventually my father did pass away at the end of 2008. And if you recall, I wasn't released from the gag order until 2010. So basically he never knew. And actually during that same time period, both of my grandmothers passed away too. They never knew. You know, I was able to tell the people in my life who were still living by 2010. You know, by that time, I had been forced to live a lie for quite a number of years. And it really does, I think, do damage to personal relationships when you hide so much of your life for so much time.
Extraordinary. Ironically, it seemed to understand that after a few years, the FBI decided it didn't want the information it demanded and dropped the demand for the records of this client.
Yeah, that's true. It was probably 4 or 5 years into the case. The FBI suddenly dropped their demand for the information. And, you know, we're left to wonder why, because they didn't exactly justify it or explain why, but it seemed very obvious to me that they did it for tactical reasons, and I could explain to you why I think so. Basically, what it did in terms of legality, in terms of the lawsuit, was that it removed my standing, my legal standing, to continue to challenge the illegal search. Since they withdrew the request for the data, for the information, that meant that in the eyes of the law, my complaint about the illegal search was now cured. So at that point, the lawsuit that I was involved in became much more focused on First Amendment issues. And the even became much more narrow, because instead of discussing broad First Amendment issues that would affect all internet providers or all telecommunications companies, it became mainly about my personal First Amendment rights in terms of being gagged. And what I know also is that after I filed my constitutional challenge, there were two others. There was one which probably your listeners have heard about, involving a consortium of libraries in Connecticut. And those Connecticut librarians also received a national security letter, and they also challenged it, and they became co-plaintiffs in my case after we had won the first court battle. And after that, there was another online organization called archive.org, the Internet Archive, which is based somewhere in the Bay Area, I believe. They also received a national security letter, and they also challenged it. And in those cases, the cases of the librarians and the Internet Archive, the FBI did the same thing. When they challenged the unconstitutional search, the FBI would withdraw the request. And if you start to understand the scope of the use of national security letters, the FBI was issuing something like 50,000 of them per year. So there were tons and tons of them out there, and very, very few recipients of the letters ever challenged them. There were really just these three challenges. So it became a clear pattern that every time someone would challenge it and they would start to win in the courts, and the courts would recognize that their complaints about violations of the Constitution were true, then the FBI would withdraw the request, and that would moot their case in terms of the search. So I believe that they did that for purely tactical reasons, although I can't prove it. But yeah, that's what happened. I never did hand over the data that they were requesting. And frankly, if the government had just gone through the proper legal channel, if they had just gone to a judge and showed some type of probable cause and then gotten a real subpoena or a real search warrant, I would have been forced to hand over the information, and I would have considered that legitimate. But instead of doing that, the government decided to spend millions of dollars fighting it in court and trying to do an end run around the Fourth Amendment and avoid having to go to court. I think that that's part of what this is all about, really, is the government trying to erode our system of checks and balances, where now under these statutes, the executive branch, as the Justice Department and the FBI is really part of the executive branch, can now basically write its own warrant without going before a judge and without ever having to show any kind of proof that the target of their investigation is even suspected of a crime. The National Security Letters statute sets a certain standard in terms of what is the burden of proof that the FBI has to meet in order to issue one of these letters. And the standard is extremely low. It's basically what's called relevant. And all it means is that the FBI has to assert that the information they're seeking is relevant to some investigation of someone. And it doesn't have to be the target. It can be that the target knows someone who knows someone who knows someone who is suspected of something. So basically, it means that the government can get information on virtually anyone without ever having to go to court or ever having to show probable cause, which is the basic standard under the Fourth Amendment that we all learn about in school.
Well, this is in the same mindset in the government of the warrantless wiretaps, which bypass the Justice Department, bypass judges, which still exist. And although the president had criticized those during his running for office, they're still existing.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's in the same category of warrantless searches. There's also the sneak and peek searches under the Patriot Act, where they break into your house and never tell you that they've been inside. There's this whole issue that's in the courts right now, and the Supreme Court is hearing it right now about a case of attaching GPS trackers to people's cars without a warrant. Similarly, there's a whole issue of phone companies and the government tracking people's whereabouts using the GPS in their mobile phone. As far as I'm concerned, this is all a pattern of using technology, the technology that we've all come to rely on in our daily lives, to track us wherever we go.
Well, there are those who also see Facebook as a way in which people provide the information themselves on who their friends and contacts are.
That's true. People do make that argument all the time. And I, on one level, I agree with it. It seems, creepy. But at the same time, a major difference there is that with Facebook, everyone knows that's what's going on, and it's voluntary. And so, to me, while it's still upsetting, it's a different issue. With Facebook, you agree to give up your information, and you sign an agreement, or you agree to an agreement online. With the National Security Letter issue and with these other forms of warrantless wiretapping and spying, there's no consent involved. And so, to me, I feel that's a different issue.
Yes.
I mean, the Bill of Rights itself, you know, its purpose is to limit the power of government. And so that, to me, is the big problem with these other forms of warrantless wiretapping.
My guest is Nicholas Merrill. If you have any comments or questions for Nick, the phone number, of course, here is 895-2448. Did the person who the FBI wanted to find out about, did he ever or she ever learn that they were, he or she was a subject of an FBI investigation?
Unfortunately, that is really one of the issues that I completely cannot address due to the gag order.
Yeah.
Some of the things that the FBI really doesn't want me to talk about are the target of the national security letter that I received and the types of information that the FBI asked me for. So I can't really talk too much about the target. What I can say with certainty, with absolute certainty, is that I never told that target that I'd gotten a letter in regards to them or their organization, or whether they were an individual or an organization, I can't really say. You know, whether they knew or not, I'm not really certain. But all I can say is that I didn't tell. The problem, in a way, with some of these things is that these people's rights are being violated, I believe, and then they never find out about it. And then they never really have the right to challenge the seizure of their data. Sometimes it's very personal, private data. If you think about what people do on the internet these days, they communicate, they have a lot of all their written communication in terms of email. You know, people don't really write letters that much anymore. So people go on online dating sites, people buy things that they don't want everyone to know about. People conduct all their medical affairs online. People do a lot of their political, you know, activities online. We've seen this, you know, lately with the Occupy Wall Street movement or the Arab Spring or, you know, the Iranian revolution from a couple of years ago, attempted revolution, that the whole political sphere has moved online. And what the government can do with techniques like national security letters is they can unmask anonymous internet speech without any kind of suspicion of wrongdoing. So they can figure out who's writing what and who talks to who and do a big data mining operation where they map out who talks to who. And this is without you having consented to give all that kind of information to Facebook or some private organization. This is just looking through email and internet logs.
Now, what's really frightening is in your article, the most recent article in the Washington Post, you were asked to provide 16 categories of electronic communication transactional records, including email address, account number, and billing information, but all the other categories remain redacted by the FBI, which means you're not allowed to tell what those are, but there are 16 categories. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, it was literally like a laundry list of all the types of information that an internet provider might have on its customers. And realistically, not everyone really understands how much information your ISP, your internet provider, may have on you. And it's not even that they are intentionally trying to gather information on you necessarily, although some might be. But even just through necessity and through the way technically things work, internet providers sometimes have equipment that tries to speed up your experience when you're browsing the web by being a proxy that stands in between the individual who's viewing the web and the website. And they cache all that information. And what that results in is the internet provider having a log of every website that a person has gone to, and not only what they're reading, but also what they're writing. They may have a lot of information in terms of email, in terms of who a person's emailing, who's emailing you, and specific times, dates, all kinds of information. Really, it's incredibly intrusive. It would be very, very difficult, I think, to compile that much information about a person through other means. I mean, through following them around or digging in their trash. So really what it represents is a whole order of magnitude more intrusive kind of surveillance than what was possible prior to the advent of the internet and this type of technology.
Now, you're a small internet server. Presumably, other internet servers across the country, big and small, have received similar letters about individuals. Are you aware of any other internet servers that were in your situation?
No, I'm not. And that's basically because of the gag orders. We know that that the government was putting out roughly 50,000 national security letters per year. And if you stop and do some math, the Department of Justice Inspector General did an audit of the FBI's use of NSL. This happened after the judge had ruled the statute to be unconstitutional. The Inspector General then released the results of the audit. And some of the statistics in there showed that between 2003 and 2006, the FBI had put out roughly 200,000 NSL. Now, if you do the math, that works out to be roughly one NSL per 1,500 Americans. But that math there makes the assumption that each letter has a one-to-one correspondence with a person. But they don't necessarily. Some of the other information that came out in the Inspector General's report was that some of the national security letters were not targeted at one person, but at huge groups of people. Pardon me. One of the famous examples was that the FBI issued one national security letter which obtained all the names of every person that had been in Las Vegas over New Year's Eve of, I believe it was 2004. There was another example that he pointed out where the FBI obtained all the information of the owners of 11,000 phone numbers.
Hmm.
So when I say it seems to be one per 1,500 Americans,
it's
that's being
greater.
Generous and assuming a one-to-one relationship, one letter per one target. In some cases, there was many more than one target. In actuality, it could be way more than one per 1,500 Americans. It could be one per 1,000 Americans or one per 500 Americans. And since technically national security letters are only supposed to be used in two basic situations, in terms of suspected agents of a foreign power, like international espionage, or terrorism suspects, it begs the question, are there really that many terror suspects or international espionage?
This is a very, very interesting. I don't want to cut you off, but we've come to the end of the program. Very quickly, I wanted to ask you if people can get information about the Calyx Institute by going on that website, Calyx Institute, which Nick Merrill has founded after this experience. And on Nick Merrill, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. It's been a very enlightening program, and I'm sure it's going to get the listeners to do a lot of thinking about what's happening in this country and our encroachment and the police state that many of us have been living in, and you particularly. Thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
All right, Jarvie. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for having me on the show.
It was our pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.